This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Out of Concord and into smoky bars around the country, the Avett brothers worked on their particular brand of music and entertainment, gained a following one fan at a time, and recently appeared at Radio City Music Hall. It has been a long haul that is paying off at last with national recognition. But while the band was writing music, rehearsing, traveling, performing, Scott Avett, the banjo-playing brother, was also working on a different artistic expression or form of artistic expression. Scott has carved out a career in the visual arts, and it too is now paying off. Scott is a painter, illustrator, printmaker, and sculptor whose technique is constantly evolving, and he joins us now to talk about his art, his music, and the search for truth in art and faith. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Let me turn the right microphone on. There you go.
Thank you for having me, Mike.
You're welcome. And you've been on this program twice, usually with the band.
That's
playing.
Right. That's right.
And here you are. Is this comfortable for you, just talking?
This has become very comfortable. We've done a lot of talk. I've always talked a lot throughout my life. I always joke with my wife or Seth sometimes when we're on the road about at the end of a day, I kind of just get sick of myself because I've just talked and talked and talked, and it's enough. But we have gotten very used to it because Seth and I, Bob as well, have done a lot of traveling, talked to a lot of people across the world. And it's become something that sometimes is very enjoyable and very enlightening and very exciting, and sometimes not so much.
But. Yeah. You talk about talking a lot, and obviously you have this storehouse of things that need to come out, either through your music or through your art. Where do you think that comes from? Where does all this stuff come from?
Sure, sure. I have no idea where it comes from. Well, I have no idea where it comes from. Yes, that's true. But I was thinking on the way here about how when, as long as I can remember, when I was a child, I always behaved like everybody's watching me. Everybody's thinking about and caring what I'm doing and what my next move was. And I think that's pretty normal for most children with an imagination. Embarrassingly enough, I still do that. And that might be why Willie Nelson still does what he does, because maybe he just feels like everybody's still watching and everybody, and they are.
Is that ego talking, or is that, how does that define your behavior? If people are watching you, you're going to be a good boy, aren't you?
Well, yeah, well, no, exactly the opposite, right? Exactly, exactly. It is exactly the opposite. It was never music or necessarily visual arts that drove me when I was young. It was, how could I stir the room up and how could I get a rise in the crowd? Music has been a vehicle to channel that. Dinner with the in-laws is not the place to channel that. So music sort of, it fell into this funnel of music and art to where I had a place to put that energy in. And it's actually turned to where this need to entertain or draw attention, create something that draws attention, it's better place now than it was at one time in my life, to where now my family and personal life is a rather quiet and extremely normal.
So you found a way to channel this need for attention and this need to express yourself into something that is appreciated, as opposed to, oh, here he goes again.
Yeah, exactly. And that's all in hindsight.
Yeah.
You know, I think it just happened out of, make a mistake, correct it, make a mistake, and the mistakes to come that I'll try to correct and channel more, areas of my life in the right ways, hoping to do well. But yes, absolutely.
So what came first for you, music or painting and drawing and all that other?
Absolutely. Our father was relatively musical. He's a great singer, a good songwriter, and always shared music with us. But he also was a self-made engineer. He was a welder on bridges, so he was forced to be creative with how he supported angle iron and to pass code, I suppose, or to pass inspection. And with that, I was thinking of this the other day. With that, he was always drawing. And I saw those around a lot, on graph paper, on this old desk, with his cigarette, his ashtray, and these old Coors Light calendars and whatnot. But seeing that and these doodles definitely translated. And the indirect relationship with that, as well as a direct relationship with he would play games with us, like draw a little shape and say, okay, what is this a part of? And then we would, he let us draw the rest of the object, whatever it was, make it up. If it was a turtle, he might have drawn a little half moon shape and it'd be the head of the turtle or whatever. That was a game we played a lot. We used to go to church and just draw characters in the church. So if we saw one of the old church members that was a little funny looking, we would, throughout the service, draw characters of this person. Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure somebody could shake their finger at you and say, oh, you know, this is not worship. Mm-hmm. Or is it really? Is this, you know, looking back on it, I think, you know, these are very sacred times for me, very special and very enlightening times for me to spend that time with my family and do these things that just lit our hearts up, you know, drawing and laughing.
Was this in your grandfather's church?
It is the same church. Yeah, that was my grandfather's church. My grandfather passed the same year I was born.
Oh, okay.
So I was baptized by my grandfather, and then he passed away later. He fell off of a ladder. He was early 60s and fell off of a ladder and thought he was fine and wasn't. But to get back to the question, I don't mean to stray it. Okay. Both the music and the visual were flowing and always encouraged if we showed an interest.
You know, you do so many things and you do them well. You play banjo, you play piano, drums and guitar. You write music. You're mm-hmm. an accomplished artist in many mm-hmm. different forms of visual art.
Mm-hmm.
How much of that is natural talent and how much of that is just pure hard work?
I think the pure hard work kind of has to be there. By default, I've learned how to play songs on the piano on stage because I've had to get the songs that I wrote out. I might just barely squeeze them out on the piano enough to illustrate what I'm trying to write, and then the hard work comes in where it's like, okay, now we got to become proficient on this instrument. Same thing with a paintbrush. Mm-hmm. I think I want to express what I saw when I was viewing this model or what I see when I'm viewing this model and want to bring whatever this relationship is out. I better pick up a brush and practice and learn. And that definitely hard work, but I don't think it's any different than learning how a ratchet works or a hammer. Over time, as you do it, there's rhythms and angles that you have to know.
You know, I have a friend who is an artist. He's a comic book artist.
Mm-hmm.
And he believes, and he's very good, and has a national reputation, and he believes that there's no such thing as talent.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at his work and think, I couldn't do that if you chained me to a wall for the rest of my life.
Right, right.
So I think there is talent. Do you think there's such a thing as talent?
I'm on the fence about that. I think that he might be onto something.
It's just work. It's just focusing. Because you said, I think you said this, decide what you want to be and be it.
Yeah, in a song, certainly. I do believe that 100%. I do believe that. I do think that persistency and hard work.
Yeah, but I'd like to be a brain surgeon, but I wouldn't be very good at
it. I tried to be a veterinarian in college, and it did not happen. It did not happen. I can't throw clay on a wheel at all. I tried so hard to do that, and I'm very hands-on and love. I could not get it in college. But this is not to push you forward, but some of the readings of my grandfather's book that we'll talk about a little bit led to, there was the wee bit factor Leo Tolstoy talks about in a book called What is Art, or in an essay leading up to it. He talks about the wee bit factor, and he says that some people, you have to be born with this, but you understand that wee bit movement. This leg needs to be moved just this much on that couch, and this couch needs to be, or this tree needs to be just this far over. And if nature takes care of that, you know, something greater than any of us will ever understand takes care of that in nature. But we play nature on recording, on canvas, on a piece of marble, within a piece of marble, if you will. So this wee bit factor is something that some people, I think, understand or pick up on earlier.
It's like a vision.
For some reason.
They have the vision to see how it should be.
For some reason. But I do think that it's got to be somebody. They're practicing something early, more so than maybe someone else. Who knows?
You just mentioned Leo Tolstoy. His name has never come up on this program in 13 years. I would never have expected it to come up today.
that's part of why I'm here, I think.
Yes. and you mentioned that you went in college, you thought about being a veterinarian. I understand that you went to college and you came out with a double major. You went to college in hopes of majoring in radio broadcasting mm-hmm. with an art minor, and what you came out with was a double major.
I did.
Why broadcasting? What did you want to do with that?
I really had no idea. The truth was, I was starting to run out of time, and I was failing a lot of classes. And I'd never failed before, but I'd never really applied myself. And in 2 years in, I said, I have to find a degree that I'm going to be able to finish within 5 or 6 years, because that's as much as I can be here. So I went to communications. I had no idea if that had anything to do with broadcasting or not. Right. Just communications. That sounds pretty broad. I'll try that. Pretty general. So I tried it, found this broadcasting thing that was also TV in the performance area, which I loved. It was right at my alley. You know, I formed a love for radio there and did that whole scenario with the minor in art. And then as I was finishing, a professor by the name of Leland Wallen, who was a student of Philip Perlstein, who was a famous figurative painter, instructed me on my first oil painting. And he's the one that advised me to stay in. Don't rush out of school. Stay in another 2 years and get this degree. Finish your art degree, because this is what you were born to do. This is what you need to be doing. Yeah. And he actually told me at the same time, I know you're in bands. Put those away. Walk away from it. This is what you were born to do. And I had to make a call.
You didn't follow his advice totally.
I did follow his schedule, which was to go to Florida to graduate school and then move to New York City. Mm-hmm. And I did apply to Florida, University of Florida. Mm-hmm. I was accepted and deferred. The next year I was deferred and we were up for Merlefest. And I told my brother, if we get into Merlefest, I'll not go. And if we don't, I'm going to go to graduate school. Right. And they accepted us to Merlefest. So it was Merlefest or graduate school.
Do you regret that?
Not at all. Not at all. No. Because I paint probably more now than if I had gone through and become a professor. Mm-hmm. I paint a very healthy amount for me.
When he told you that this is what you were born to do, mm-hmm. painting, mm-hmm. How did you react to that? Because obviously you were looking for something to be, someone to be.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. You know, in your early right. 20s, you really are looking for somebody to be. I felt very egotistical about it. Like, yeah, bam, I just did my first oil painting and there it is. And maybe I'm just a natural. And, took his words seriously because I respected him immediately. Mm-hmm. But the next semester and the next, the true challenge, kind of like beginner's luck.
Right.
Yes, there was a natural ability, but then the true challenges of what does it mean to truly develop as a painter and as someone who forms images on canvas, that was a bigger job than just beginner's luck and being a natural. You can be a natural. Because mm-hmm. if you really think about it, there's probably millions of naturals out there that never harness that ability or that instinct.
Well, there are a lot of people out there who never figure out who they should be or what their natural talent is, and other people are blessed like you with a lot of different choices. You could go in the musical direction. You could have gone into broadcasting. You could have been a painter full time or a teacher of art full time. When you're blessed with so many choices, is it a blessing or is it? Do you worry about having made the right decision?
I don't have time to now. I can only move forward.
Right.
Absolutely. And I can't do any of it without help from a lot of people.
Seth Abbott is our guest. He is a member of the Abbott Brothers, but we're going to talk about his art as we go through this hour because he's making a name for Scott Abbott. We're coming right back.
Charlotte Talks continues in just a moment here on listener-funded 90.7 FM WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and 10,000 Villages, a fair trade source for handmade holiday gifts and decor, featuring jewelry, handbags, scarves, ornaments, nativities, and table linens. Located at Cotswold Village Shops and on the web at 10,000villages.com. Coming up tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, it's our Christmas Eve special. Join us for our special Christmas Eve edition of the show where we look back on holidays past from the life and times of Charles Dickens to Depression-era Christmases in Charlotte. We'll also visit with a Charlotte musician who's left us a lasting gift of Christmas music. When Charlotte Talks, tomorrow morning at 9, here on 90.7 FM WFAE. More with Scott Abbott in just a moment.
on the next Ian Rehm Show, Life After Loss. Essayist and PBS NewsHour commentator Roger Rosenblatt. He recounts the struggle to help his son-in-law and three young grandchildren cope with the sudden death of his 38-year-old daughter.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning at 10, right after Charlotte Talks, on listener-funded 90.7 FM, WFAE.
Load the car and write the note. Grab your bag and grab your coat. Tell the ones that need to know. We are headed north. One foot in and one foot back. But it don't pay to live like that. So I cut the ties and I jump the tracks, for never to return. Oh, Brooklyn, Brooklyn, take me in. Are you aware the shape I'm in? My hands, they shake, my head, it spins. Oh, Brooklyn, Brooklyn, take me in.
The Abbott Brothers, and I and Love and You, which was an award-winning song, was it not?
I think so. I think
you
so.
You don't know.
Well, I think so. That's what I'm told. I get emails, and
I love
Dolph,
that.
Our manager, keeps us well informed. He toots our horn back at us, so he keeps us inspired that way.
Scott Avett, whose brother's name is Seth. Scott Avett is our guest today. We're talking about his art, his visual art, painting and sculpturing and illustration. I saw your art in Noda several years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was shortly after we talked once on the radio, and I think Dolph said, you know, Seth and you are both artists. And he said, Scott's art is on display in Noda. You need to go see it. And I thought, okay, well, I'll go see it. Blew me away.
Thank you.
I mean, it's really impressive. And there are different styles of art, and that's just the style of art that speaks to me. I don't know, how would you define what you do?
Well, do you mean figurative or do you mean representational?
In terms of the way you actually paint, the brush strokes, the choice of colors to make colors that you wouldn't expect to be there are there, but they make sense.
Understood, right.
Yeah.
Leland Wallen is a big part of that, the professor I mentioned mm-hmm. earlier in the show. He pushed the philosophy or the idea of faceting colors and making like puzzles, pieces of cools and warms, mm-hmm. Blues and reds and golds and greens. And when I painted that way, he always was very flattering and encouraging to me. Over the years, I've mixed much more paint, and it's a much smoother paint. And I look at the show that you saw at the time, I was painting much more directly mm-hmm. with thick paint and with one brush stroke with one color, and then the next one was another color, and mm-hmm. it's somewhat choppy and faceted. Over the years, though, just like anything, you become interested in refining what you do, and with that comes change. Mm-hmm. Whatever your definition of refinement is, it might be refinement might mean more lo-fi to you, and perfecting the lo-fi thing or the more faceted approach and the more chopped up approach. With this comes a philosophy of I don't know why this comes to mind with me in talking about this, but you know, I talk like I know what I'm saying as far as this development in my painting or whatever, but I really don't. I really don't know about this refinement and where it's going and where it may end up.
You don't know because it's not conscious? It's just happening as you paint?
It should, right, exactly. It should be my conscience just working freely mm-hmm. as I can allow it. And I used to be pretty put off by Jackson Pollock or Rothko. You know, I used to right. just think, well, what's going on here? And I'm absolutely 180 the opposite now.
Well, yeah, because I read a quote from an essay that you wrote about truth and art, and basically you said a lot of people don't understand those artists, but their use of color, and pretty much that's all it is, it's just color, is the purest form of truth in art there can be.
Exactly. How much more simple and true can you get than one square of color, whether you like the fact that it drew success.
But, you know,
or
I
not.
Think a lot of people look at a Jackson Pollock or a Morris Lewis and they say, well, it's just colors on a canvas. I could do that.
I know.
When I look at your work, I know I can't do that.
Right.
I mean, I couldn't do Jackson Pollock either.
I can't
but
either.
I think I can. I know I can't do what you do or when Renoir did. Or
right.
I know I can't.
Right.
So when you look at your earlier work, and you're in this, because we change over time.
Absolutely.
Do you like it? Are you embarrassed by it? Do you appreciate it for what it is or what it was? How do you feel about it?
I'm curious about it. A lot of times I look at it and I'm kind of mystified by who was that made that. I find paintings that I forgot I did, rolled up, I took off bars, and I don't remember who did them, and I can admire them as a different person because I am a different person.
Yeah.
And they were from a time that I was developing this, whatever was next, mm-hmm. which I'm now developing. Whatever.
Would you want people to see those or the ones that you're just rediscovering?
Yeah, I've thrown away and burned quite a few.
Wow.
One or the other. Yeah. I'd read a book like, something about Michelangelo where he would destroy all his drawings or this, and then I'd go on this rant where I needed to destroy everything. I don't really feel that way that much anymore because there's a lot of evidence and education and seeing those for me. So I don't really do that.
There are a lot of performers who are very good at what they do and don't like necessarily to listen to themselves in playback.
Yeah.
They're always hypercritical. I could have done that better. I don't like the way I sound on that note, whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're like that in the studio or not, or with your music. Are you like that with your art? I mean, do you look at things and think, I should have done that better. I shouldn't have done that color there. I shouldn't have done that paint stroke. Maybe I shouldn't even have tackled this subject matter. Do you feel like that?
I don't because the paintings can always change. I can always take them off the wall, even after they're shown, which I've done. I've shown the last show I had, along with I and Love and You Release, I had a small show in New York City,
mm-hmm.
and the paintings that were there have come down and been painted, you know, over and changed. And you kind of can't feel that way because if you're looking at it saying, I should have done this, well, go do it. Put it on the easel and do it. Paint over if you want.
You know, when you're performing, you get an immediate feedback from
really
the
do.
Audience. You know whether they're on to you or whether they like you or whether they're with you. And fortunately for you, they are. They're on your side.
It seems that way.
They love what you do. When you paint in isolation. And then one day, if you're lucky, the paintings go up in a gallery someplace and people come in. And there's usually an opening night show and the artist is usually in attendance. Is that nerve-wracking? Because no one has seen this stuff but you before. And suddenly there it is, and people are walking through and looking at it.
Yeah, it is. It is. And there's a vulnerability about it that mm-hmm. is terrifying, that I used to go in, you know, just head first without any reservations. And I don't do that as well anymore. However, I think that there's a bigger need to go into it head first without any hesitations. And I do agree. There is no telling what people, how they'll react to subject matter, to figures, to nude figures.
Mm-hmm.
People make a deal out of that in different ways. And there's plenty of that in my paintings.
Yeah, there is. I was actually surprised by that. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of both female and male nudes mm-hmm. in the paintings. And mm-hmm. This is not New York City. You know, we're where we are.
We are.
Do you get negative reactions by that?
I haven't shown in years, but I have had a show once where I had sent the work down and I had gone through how it was to be hung, mm-hmm. or at least been told how it would be hung. And then when I showed up to the reception,
mm-hmm.
one of the works was gone and in the back somewhere. And I asked about it. And I recall maybe the director saying that, oh, it's in the back room with some paintings that are back here. It's another gallery space. And, you know, that's okay. It's not my place. And I understood. So I left it alone. At this point, if someone running a gallery would not want that in their, their gallery, then it's just not the place for me to show.
There's a history of that in art.
There is. And my work is not, it isn't based on sexual desires.
No, it's not.
It's removed from that.
Right.
I have no problem with my 2-year-old daughter walking among my studio and seeing any of it. It's kind of anatomy, really.
Right.
Yeah, I don't really see any problem with it at all. It's really a non-issue to me.
Scott Avitt's work, by the way, can be seen on our website if you'd like to see some of it. It's not all there, but some of it's there at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. And by the way, the Avitt brothers performed live on our show back in 2005, and you can hear that show on our website as well at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. Between all the things you have to do, you're touring the country, you're recording, you're writing music, you're rehearsing. I assume you have to rehearse.
We should.
Yeah.
We should rehearse.
When do you and you're on the road a lot. When do you have time to paint?
I didn't paint a lot this year. I go out on the road, and I gather inspiration. I go to museums. I see a lot of people in a lot of different parts of this country, and we've this year began to see a lot of different parts of the world. And I come home with a pile of this inspiration. And in the studio is where I go and work. And over the past 2 years since I've become a father, I've forced myself, or I've had no choice, to learn to work faster and faster and faster, more productive. I used to go to the studio and stay for a day and get very little done, and kind of pace the room, thinking things through. Now I've just compartmentalized my thinking time, so when it's due time, I go and do, and that's it. There really is no thinking. There's just go, 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 go.
When you go in, do you go in with something in mind? I mean, or a subject matter, a painting, a theme, or do you just face a blank canvas, and start painting?
I absolutely go in with the theme. I'll use an example here, like the cover of our record, I in Love and You, painting titled Julianne in Vain. I went in with intentions to do Vanitas, or the Vanities of Human Life painting, which there's a history of these still lifes, which were a pile of symbols based on the vanities of human life. They just range from drumsticks to conch shells to compasses and hourglasses and skulls. I wanted to do a Vanities of Human Life with a human figure in it. As I worked, the relationship between me and the subject matter broke down to basically two elements, yes and no, or life and death, and hello and goodbye, and which equaled the most simplified version of change. It was the living woman and the skull, which was the inevitable death. So it was kind of like day and night sort of thing. And I left it at that. Compositionally, it was the only way I could go. My reason for making that example or using that example is that I went in with something very different. The relationship between me and the painting, and like I said, my conscience just pushed me to do that. I don't know why the composition had to work that way. I don't know why I needed to simplify and simplify. This is all critical thinking in hindsight. A lot of the theories that I've made on it are hindsight.
You know, I've talked to a lot of writers who say some of them will say that they start out with an outline for a book, a novel that they're writing, and suddenly the characters take on a life of their own. Mm-hmm. They dictate what they're going to do. The storyline changes because of what the characters tell the writer they're going to do. Same thing happened with painting. If you go in with an idea, things just happen that you have no idea why they're happening, but you feel compelled to put that brushstroke there.
I believe that 100%. This really has no weight to it at all, but I made a painting of a married couple, photographer friends of ours, and I don't know why, but it was the composition with both of them in it was terrible. Something told me to take the one character out. Within the next year or 2 years of their relationship and our relationship, they were divorced. And the one that I was in closer contact with, I still love them both. And still very good friends with them, but the one that I still know very well was still sitting there, and there's no weight to that at all. But there's a story that was told. And in hindsight, there's a story that's told.
Well, perhaps you saw something that nobody else saw, which is why you're an artist.
It's pretty neat.
Well, there's a spiritual side to this, too, and that's one of the things that you talk about. Is that the spiritual side of it, do you think, that it's coming from someplace else? It's not coming necessarily from you, but it's coming from maybe a human connection to, I don't even know how to express this, a human connection to the universe? Some people can see and some people can't?
Well, I can't. You know, I don't claim to be any different than any other person. And I think that that move that I made with that painting was compositionally, it was not working. So once again, back to that wee bit theory or wee bit factor, the one had to go. And I spent, of course, the next week apologizing to the other for taking her out of the painting. But the spiritual connection is, my belief is that art is just an extension of my faith. It's kind of a tool of it. I believe that my conscience, as I spoke of a little while ago, is the closest thing I can get to the voice of truth coming in. And if I follow that when I'm working, writing songs, performing, painting, drawing, if I follow that, and I've done plenty of times, there's been plenty of times where I did not follow it and made bad work and had to chunk it and start again, and I have mounds of that. But if I follow that, I think that's the closest thing I can see directly as a link between the two. But I do believe that the two don't exist without each other. Spirituality can't exist, I think, without art, but I really don't think art can exist without spirituality.
You know, we've spoken several times before on the air about music and about getting ready to be famous and all that good stuff. You are not at all what people, I think, who don't know you would think you're like because of your music and the way the Avett brothers act when they, or have acted in the past. I know that's changing too.
Absolutely.
When you perform, and you're at first you were just kind of wild and crazy guys having a great time and making music and people going crazy because they love what you were doing.
We were.
But you're a thinker. You're a spiritual person. You're a man of faith, as you have self-described. You are not the same guy that's up there on the stage playing that music. Do you know that, or is it?
I'm afraid of that. I think that has a little bit to do with the channel thing that I was talking about earlier. There's a place for that.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes that doesn't represent everything that I might believe personally.
Right. Do you think your fans who don't know you well personally would be surprised about the faith aspect?
I think they may be. They may be. I think that we have a lot of fans that would hope that Seth and I would be thoughtful. And we hope that our lyrics, which we put a lot of thought into, come across as thoughtful. I guess if you could have a thoughtful celebration is what you kind of think about or you would hope happens with our music, because it gets jubilant. But if it's thoughtful still, there's no reason to just abandon the thought altogether.
Right.
I think that's something to think about.
Scott Avett is our guest. You can see some of his art on our website, wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're talking about his art. We're going to talk some more about the search for truth in art and faith as we go through the hour. Stay with the Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
More of our conversation with Scott Avett from the Avett Brothers in just a moment on Charlotte Talks, here on listener-funded 90.7 FM, WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Halcyon Flavors from the Earth, a farm-to-fork dining experience with Chef Mark Jacksina in the new Mint Museum Uptown. Halcyon serving lunch and dinner. Reservations at 704-910-0865. Coming up next in about 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, Life After Loss. SAS and PBS NewsHour commentator George Rosenblatt recounts the struggle to help his son-in-law and three young grandchildren cope with the sudden death of his 38-year-old daughter. That's a rebroadcast of the Diane Rehm Show coming up next at 10 here on 90.7 FM, WFAE. Charlotte Talks returns in a moment.
Win an Apple iPad and a $100 iTunes gift certificate to enjoy in the new year, all compliments of WFAE. Help us keep you informed with in-depth news by making a tax-deductible contribution by December 31st, and you'll automatically be entered into the contest. No gift is necessary to enter, but your support makes the news coverage you use possible. Get more details at WFAE.org.
Flooded in light, in the fine print that tell me what's wrong and what's right, and it comes in black and it comes in white, and I'm frightened by those who don't see it, where nothing is owed, deserved, or expected. And your life doesn't change by the man that's elected. If you're loved by someone you're never rejected, decide what to be and go be it. There was a dream, and one day I could see it. Like a bird in a cage, I broke in. Somebody free it. And there was a kid with a head full of doubt. So I'll scream till I die. All the last of those bad thoughts are finally out.
Scott Avett and the Avett Brothers there, a head full of doubt, road full of promise, which I think is illustrative of the thinking person in you. I mean, those are really there's some profound statements in that song.
Sure, sure. Yeah. It was a song that took a lot of thought. It was a song that actually the producer, Rick Rubin, insisted was on the record. It was one that almost didn't make the record because of the weightiness of it. We were not sure if there was not already enough weightiness on the record, because we do believe in a variety and a diversity to the weight of a record.
Rick Rubin is the producer of your latest CD, and he's a guy that has worked with, gosh, I'm looking for his thing here and I can't find it, but he's worked with a bunch of people.
Johnny Cash, yeah, Johnny, the Beastie Boys.
He revived Johnny Cash.
He really, apparently.
Career. How did you get hooked up with him?
He contacted us and invited us to his house, and we went to Malibu and visited with him, and it was much like you and I talking. He was just a guy that appreciated what we did and said, if we can be friends, maybe we could work together. Mm-hmm. And you know, either we are cut out to be friends or not, and it'd be great if we are. And turned out, we beyond the record, we'd become closer and closer in our philosophy on making things. Mm-hmm. Which is, make good things and everything else will follow. And don't worry about the success of things, the quote unquote success of things. Keep it away. You know, when we were, quick example, when we were sequencing the record, I Am Loving You, Rick told us all, take your marketing hats off, because we're working on passion here. We're working on integrity. We're not working on marketing.
You wrote an essay about
mainstream
truth,
music.
Yeah, truth. And yes. And you were talking about, you're very critical of the music business with justification, essentially saying that this whole way that radio has approached music has changed music, and not for the better, mm-hmm. for the worse. And that it's changed people who create music, because now they create because they want to have success. And they want to duplicate the success that came before. Mm-hmm. And it's not about the truth of what they're saying or doing or playing or singing. It's about being successful, and that is not success.
Mm-mm. It's terrifying to hear that. And I try to just open my ears to mainstream radio and listen to it and find good things. And every now and again, you feel this wild card, mm-hmm. this great little song. But it's one thing after another. That's okay. If that's the reality and that's mainstream, then I'll just bow out and do my thing. I have a feeling that people want more. I have a feeling that people.
But now you're getting a taste of success. I mean, you were on Conan, Radio City Music Hall. Were you on Letterman too? I think
Letterman. Yeah.
by any standard measure of success, that is success. And,
sure.
And you have this Rick Rubin guy producing an album. You're on Columbia Records now.
Sure.
I mean, that is success. How do you stay true to yourself? How do you sure. avoid the temptation of that's got to be being put on you by Columbia to sell more records?
Sure, sure. Well, our biggest blessing is the trail of failure that we had before any of these types of successes that you're talking about. Basically acquiring these slowly mm-hmm. helped embed in us a hesitation or a weariness that we're allowed to take it for what it is. And I think that the weight cannot be on whether you're on Letterman or not. Letterman's a great guy. He was very nice. We played. It was fun. It was nerve-wracking. It was scary. Love to do it again. That's not the nucleus of what we do.
Right.
The nucleus is what will happen this afternoon that will move me to write whatever's next or move Seth to write whatever's next. That's the gold that matters, whether it brings gold or not or brings us on the air.
Is everybody in the group on the same page?
Yes. Yes. And we have 9 guys that we travel mm-hmm. with that we've, Seth and Bob and I, have one by one selected each of them to come in one at a time, and it's been a very slow growing process. Mm-hmm. And we all, you know, we're the kind of guys that put our arms around each other, and we all love each other very much. There's nobody you don't know.
Right.
So it's a really good feeling. We're very protective of that.
Because it would seem to me that as some people get a taste of the kind of success that you are now experiencing, that mm-hmm. they really may want more of it. They want the nice house, the fancy car. They'd like to be famous. They'd like to sell a million records every time a record comes out. And, mm-hmm. and maybe you don't feel that way, but they do.
Right. We've got a whole team that's very level-headed, and I think we all keep each other in line.
After years of playing in smoky bars and on the backs of trucks in shopping centers and just trying to attract an audience, and as Dolph told us when he was on the show several times in the past, he believes in anybody he manages or handles or records to build their fan base one fan at a time, which takes a long time. And today everybody wants to be famous for what just to be famous, and they want it now.
They do.
They don't want to wait.
They want
it.
Everything now.
You have taken your time and built this fan base. What's it like to go from a smoky bar where you got 50 people drunk cheering you on to Letterman, to Radio City Music Hall? I mean, that's got a... When you look out from Radio City Music Hall, it's the largest theater in America. And people who have never been there...
See, I didn't know that.
Yeah. People who have never been there have no conception of how big that place is.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Oh, it's tall. Yeah.
So when you stand on that stage and you look out...
It's very rewarding. And it's very flattering. It's an honor. I think if it had been fast. But don't get me wrong. Seth and I, if we could have had it now, we wanted it now. We had no master plan. Mm-hmm. But the slow growth to Letterman or Radio Music Hall or Radio City Music Hall, the slow growth allowed us to be very welcoming to it, very comfortable with it, eager to do it, and thankful, just thankful to do it. I don't know if we'd been as thankful if we'd gotten it now.
So that night on, you pick a show, in the Letterman and then Conan have a national television audience, but it's different. Because it's, I don't know how many people are in the theater at Letterman,
yeah.
maybe a couple hundred.
It's very different.
But Radio City Music Hall seats thousands of people. I mean, no apprehension, no nerves, no extra nerves?
Well, we wouldn't have had nerves if we hadn't invited all of our friends like Paleface and Nicole Adkins and Langhorne Slim. We did a themed show from Radio Perfecto, which was about the size of this room. It held 25 people.
Mm-hmm.
And the theme of the show, which we didn't market, but was from Radio Perfecto to Radio City. So we brought all in that small room in Radio Perfecto was Paleface, mm-hmm. Langhorne Slim, Nicole Adkins. We brought them with us to Radio City Music Hall, and in perfect Avett form, we threw ourselves off of our game on one of the biggest nights we were going to have to where we had to learn, you know, 6 or 7 songs that day. We had to get everything in order and everything lined up, chronological, the set list working well. And it was scary. And we didn't know if it would work or if it wouldn't.
Wow. And,
but that's perfect. Like I said, that's Avett form because we have learned everything in front of people. You mentioned rehearsing earlier.
Right.
We've rehearsed in front of people all of our career. and it's just been building. That might have been why it took so long. But you made me think about something else. You know, when I just said that natural for painting came, it was an ego trip for me because I thought I'd had it. I think that if Seth and I would have seen that early, when we were 24 and 20, it would have been a very dangerous ego trip for us to go from something small to something big very fast. We needed those egos dulled down and put in place.
Plus, you know, it seems to me, I really feel sorry for a lot of kids who make it early.
I do too.
Because they've peaked at, what, 17, 18, 19, 20? You can't go much higher than the peak. It's all downhill from there, and many of them never recover from that. Whereas if you're building through your life, it sustains you.
You're absolutely right. It breaks my heart to see it as well. Because when you're young, you don't think there is any end.
Right.
You don't think that you're like somebody says, well, when this plateaus, and you're thinking, it never plateaus, I'm going to go forever.
Mm-hmm.
Bruce Springsteen's a good example of somebody that's gone for a long time.
Yeah.
That you could probably follow.
You wrote in this essay, My Search for Truth, you talk about not calling yourself an artist because you believe no one knows what that means anymore. Now, when you say artist, are you referring to yourself as a musical performer or as a painter?
Both.
Because I really do. I agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
All these people have a hit record, and suddenly they're, well, I'm an artist. No, you're not. You're a singer.
Mm-hmm. Or a songwriter, or a musician,
right,
or a performer.
You're not an artist yet.
Sure.
Where does that wisdom in you come from?
I can't say. I have no idea.
It's also humility, it seems to me. I mean, you could justifiably call yourself today as a singer and a songwriter and a performer an artist because you have a track record of success that people buy.
Mm-hmm.
And you certainly are a visual artist in that term, but you choose not to. Why not?
There's no question that the definition of what art is has been obscured for hundreds of years now. Going back to Leo Tolstoy's essays and his leading up to his book, What Is Art? He did his best, and he articulated, as he does with Christianity and spirituality, he did a great job of articulating what these things are and what they mean in me, as well as helping me articulate some of the specifics with me. But it's so hard to say what art is to you or to me or to her or to him that to call yourself something that makes that thing that nobody's really sure anymore what the definition is, I just hesitate to do it. So I'd much rather just say I'm a painter and a songwriter and a performer. By default, I'm a musician. By default, I'm a singer.
Mm-hmm.
By default, I'm a road warrior. Mm-hmm. By default, I'm an illustrator.
If it ended today, if you never had any more success as the Avett brothers and you went back to playing smoky bars, would you be satisfied with that? Would the art sustain you? The painting sustain you? Would that sustain you? Or do you want it to continue to grow and develop?
Yeah, it needs to continue to grow and develop. It needs to continue to change. It can't go in reverse and go back to what it was. If it did, it could be a novelty and happen much less. It wouldn't be something that would be sustainable.
So you don't want to be 50 and playing Holiday Inns?
Mm. Well, there's something. I can't say. I very well may be.
Let's take some a call, and I'll read you some things that have come in on Facebook and on email, etc. Beth in Morganton, welcome to the program, Beth.
Hey, good to be here. Avett Brothers are my favorite band. I see you as many times a year as I can. I'm looking forward to ringing in 2011 in Asheville with you.
Thank you.
But I was just curious. I didn't realize that you had such a young daughter. How do you balance your family life when you're on the road and involved in so many other things with your art and the band? How does that all work out for you?
Sure. It's... First, thank you again for the compliment, but it's all about just being creative with my time and trying to be as productive as I can with my time, and it can sort of build this illusion that a lot's getting done when it may not be. We log a lot of music, and I log a lot of information for visuals because the family is first and foremost the priority, and I have to put everything down. And more, if I wasn't alone, I would not put it down near as much. I put it down a lot to be there for my family. So,
is that difficult to do?
It can be. It can be.
You're a talker, and you have a lot of stuff inside that needs to come out.
I do, and it is, yeah, yeah. And it just makes me believe that life and family is just this development of letting go of you. Mm-hmm. and
are they feeding your artistic bent and your expression bent? Is it feeding you?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Because there sure are a lot of emotions when you have a family that, mm-hmm. that come in extremely intensive ways.
But it's got to be difficult to be Mrs. Scott Avid. Because you're on the road a lot. And, yeah. and people like Beth likes you. Everybody likes you that comes to these shows. And they want a piece of you.
It can be heartbreaking sometimes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Beth, thank you for your call.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. On Facebook, Carrie writes, it seems like both of Scott Avid's artistic talents have been a priority for him, and there must be some unique challenges to honoring them. I'm interested to know if he paints in any other medium and if there is a reason why he presumably prefers oil.
I'm not really sure why, but it just seems like oil is the legit medium. Seems like it's the pro medium.
It is rare on this program when suddenly the music starts, and it surprises me that the music starts.
I could stay here for another hour.
I could easily do another couple of hours. I haven't even scratched the surface of what I want to ask you, and I'll give you these emails from people that I haven't gotten to yet. I just am astounded.
Terrific.
Wow, Scott Avid is going to be speaking November 22nd, 7 p.m. at the Moroni Theater in Salisbury. All that information will be on our website. Thanks for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike.